Welcome everyone to the very first episode of the House of Wisdom podcast, where we interview academic influencers about their research and how it can shape a better future. I am Deepak Mawar, an academic.
And I'm Annie Carmid, a corporate person.
You said that with such an evil intent. So welcome everyone. This is the very first episode. We are this is part of the episode one of the launch series also. So we thought it was a really good way of introducing the podcast, what we're all about, with three episodes that are quite varying in themes. And for you guys, just to get to know us also. It's just also about, you know, getting to know myself and Anik as people. So you don't want to come back for more. It's all about kind of leaving a little snacks for them to just keep coming back and coming back. So I think that's the whole idea of having this launch series where we've got a three-parter, where we've talked about very different ideas and very different themes. And generally, the whole point of this podcast is to look at academic ideas and how they can move beyond the academic bubble and be talked about in a more plausible way. And I think, Anik, that's something you're definitely an advocate of, because some of the reservations you have about academic research is, you know, where is its tangibility?
So you just set Anik up against the whole academic world. Is that what you've done?
Hey, I'm with you. I'm behind you in that. It's not a one-man army.
I think there could be a good film, Anik Pilgrim versus the world. I think it all started really when we were preparing for your, I helped out a little bit on your preparation for the Viber,
yeah.
And I think one of the things that I picked up as I was going through, you know, reading your paper was like, there's so many awesome ideas in here that could be used in practice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my challenge constantly to you was like, how do we take these ideas and make these work, right? Like, what's your plan next with this paper that you're doing? And, you know, as we got talking, obviously I really enjoyed our conversation, and it became really apparent to me that there's so many academics out there with really great ideas, but they seem to kind of keep them constrained within the academic world. And most of these ideas don't see the light of day, or more interesting, but sadly, they just get retaught. And then that person reteaches the next person, and you create your own bubble within a bubble. So I'm really keen to have these conversations with academics and obviously put an emphasis on how we could use your ideas in practice and take them forward, right? Transcend the academic bubble.
Yeah, and I think this podcast is a great way of kind of getting some insight in how the academic world works and how we should kind of examine it and make of it. What we can make of it. What is, you know, these interesting ideas and how far they go. And I'm definitely with you in that sense, Anik, in terms of you have these projects that get built up, that get set up, and people work over these issues for 4 years potentially, or even more. And the furthest it goes is an academic conference or a big talk in front of a university and other students. But I think that's not enough. I think both you and I feel there should be a bit more interaction with the world outside of academia. And this is perhaps one way of trying to kind of bridge that gap. I think that's kind of the hope we've got. And also just because we definitely have come across some really interesting ideas, and it'd be great for other people to be able to listen about it, hear about it, and find out about it. So, you know, that's the real crux of why we've set up this this podcast. We're on this big journey, and we want to take on some and tackle some big ideas, some interesting ideas, and show you listeners about, you know, the interesting works that are, you know, being taken place.
Yeah, I agree with that, Deepak. I think, you know, for me, I think it's two big things. Like, one is we're interviewing people about themes that we find interesting. I think that's important. You know, we find all this stuff as interesting as the academics we're interviewing and hopefully the viewers that end up listening. But two as well, on surfacing these ideas and giving these academics a platform to showcase what brilliant ideas they're working on, and hopefully something does come of it, right? Maybe they use this as a way to, it triggers some new thinking.
Yeah.
And drives some of these individuals to transcend the academic bubble in one way.
So. Exactly. Yeah, I probably shouldn't make it sound like it's going to be some sort of Dragon's Den kind of environment.
Sounded like you're going to be curing these guys.
Yeah, okay, maybe yeah. We obviously want more guests to come on, so it won't be a roasting. You're right. We definitely want to promote these ideas too. It's not just about challenging them, but that's definitely something that's driven us to get to this point where we've got a podcast, we've got, you know, a website, we've got Instagram, we've got Twitter and all these things. And I suppose I'd like to just kind of give a bit of a shout out to all, some of the people that have helped us out already at the start of this journey. So the one person I want to kind of pick out straight away is the person that's done our music, our introductory music. I'm a big fan. So the guy is Leo Lopass, LeoLowPass. Check him out. His music is really cool. It's some really awesome stuff. I get real like Bonobo vibe to it. It's kind of chill hop. Nujabes, you know, you've known Nujabes, Anik. So some really cool chill out, kind of relaxing kind of music. Really cool stuff. So definitely go check out Leo Lopass on Spotify, on YouTube. Check out his Instagram page. He does some really awesome music. So definitely recommend him. What do you think of the music, Anik?
I love it, Deepak. Yeah. I think it's the right balance. It's got the right balance. It's chilled out. It's relaxing, and I think it shows. It tells the viewers what kind of people we are.
Yeah, for sure. So. Yeah, because have you heard of Nujabes? You must have heard of Nujabes. He did the music for Samurai Champloo, the anime.
Even better.
Yeah, so he reminds me a little bit like that of that kind of music, kind of like fusion of jazz. And hip hop, that kind of yeah. Vibe. So if you're into that kind of thing, kind of jazz, hip hop fusion, chill hop kind of stuff, check him out. It is some great stuff.
So we're the two wandering samurai running a podcast now, yeah?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah, for sure. And then the guy that's done our artwork and our logos, which I love. I think it encapsulates us really well. He's a really old friend of mine, Adam Khan. Definitely go check them out. So if you ever need any logos, if people out there need to get logos done, some graphic designing, absolutely check him out on Instagram and get in contact with him. His Instagram page is DrawKhanDraw. I would recommend it. He's done such a cool job with our logo. I like the simplicity of it, but it's still classy.
I really like the logo, Deepak. It's great.
Yeah.
It just captures what we are on the tin, right?
Exactly.
So, Deepa, what theme are we exploring today?
Yes, so this episode, we're looking at big data, I think, filled with some really exciting and interesting avenues for discussion. Anik, do you want to give us a little bit of a kind of a background in what big data is and the topic?
Definitely. So I think most people will be familiar with the concept of big data. I think, you know, it's clear that every day more and more of our data are going to companies, state actors, and everyone, even private people, now have access to other people's data in such an easy way. And obviously the biggest medium, you know, social media, and that's the kind of easy one to point towards in terms of where all of our data is going on a daily basis. But we talk about this all the time, and you see big data being used in so many different ways, like most recently or a few years ago in the different US and UK elections, there was a lot of talk about how data, or personal data, was being used to influence voting decisions. And it's clear companies can use it to track your location and all other types of personal things to influence your buying decisions or other types of decisions that you make. And so we felt this was a really big topic to cover, and we wanted it to be one of the first that we talked about.
Yeah, it's such a big topic for sure. And it's such an important topic in today's world that we are discussing at some length. So it's really great to have an expert discuss the actual ins and outs and the repercussions of big data, whether it be good and bad. For me, I'd almost say big data is probably the most transformative push that we've had in modern day society. I think it's changed society in so many different ways in such a drastic level. So yeah, so we've got an interesting guest. We might as well just jump straight into it.
Yeah.
In this episode, we've got a very interesting topic and a really interesting person to discuss it. So we have Professor Andres Witte, who is the Dean of the Faculty Campus Frisland at the University of Groningen. He is a his research interests are in international relations, ethics, international law and European law, with some specific expertise on big data ethics and governance, blockchain regulation, humanitarian action, state of emergency, and interdisciplinary research and education management. So some really interesting ideas, some really interesting areas of expertise. Andre, it's great to have you on this episode. How are you?
Thanks so much. It is wonderful to be on this episode with you. It is quite exciting to be able to talk about these topics. So thanks so much for having me.
Excellent. Both me and Anika are really happy to have you on here, and for sure we're really excited to talk about the topic of this episode. So, but before we get into kind of the nitty gritties and the more heady stuff, we kind of want to have some more relaxed, fun questions, just for the listeners to get to know you a little bit more and to get to know the man behind the research.
Sure, go ahead. Okay. I'm happy to answer any fun questions you have.
All right, brilliant. So I'll go off for the first one. So I think we at the House of Wisdom podcast do imagine that there is this kind of metaphorical, or maybe even a literal House of Wisdom, you know, full of books, exciting things for someone to do in this sort of house. And we came up with the idea. So if you were stuck in this House of Wisdom, especially with the idea that we know the fact that we've had a coronavirus and a lockdown. So if you were stuck in the House of Wisdom for, let's say, a month, who would be kind of the ideal person you'd want to be stuck with? And we're hoping for someone, you know, famous, dead or alive. So I know maybe family members might be happy to hear their names, but maybe something a bit more exciting with someone, you know, exciting, intriguing. Who'd come to mind?
I'd hope to bring more than one person, because, you know, if you bring a very smart person to this House of Wisdom and you're stuck with this, if this person is smarter than you, you feel very dumb in a very short time, and I don't know whether that's a good thing for your happiness. So I'd rather bring maybe somebody to philosophize with, somebody like maybe Aristotle. I think he was really one of the most profound thinkers of this world. Then somebody to have fun with. I guess my girlfriend will be really happy to hear that I would bring her for the fun part. Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess you have to also once in a while talk with friends about, you know, your daily thoughts and your concerns and so forth. Well, ideally, it's all in one person, but, you know, in this case, I'd happy to switch.
Yeah, I think Aristotle would be pretty cool. What did you think, Anik? I think that would be a pretty awesome person to have around. You definitely get some good insights into, you know, classical antiquity and stuff. But then I think, Andrea, you're right. You kind of want all that heavy intellectual stuff, but then you want to chill out too, right? Because, you know, lockdown in one space isn't just about, you know, being challenged constantly. You want to chill out and enjoy yourself a little bit.
Absolutely. And who knows, maybe Aristotle was a real dude to have a beer with, but we will never know.
Yeah, that's true, right? That is true. Aristotle could maybe be like a really cool guy. You could just start having some really good banter or some really good chats with him. So yeah, you never know. But certainly if you want someone really, if you're going to go for the highest of the highest of intellectual people, I think Aristotle's definitely a good place to start with. And I suppose, yeah, your partner will be more than happy to hear that she's along with you in this lockdown.
Certainly hope so.
Brilliant.
I think what would be interesting if you're able maybe one day in the future to combine those two together, having Aristotle as your girlfriend in your and your girlfriend in Aristotle.
Well, I don't know whether you want your girlfriend to tell you how stupid you are all the time, but
I think that would start a lot of arguments for sure. A kind of battle of the minds is never good, I suppose. So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I suppose splitting it up would be good.
Excellent. And, you know, as we also think of a few icebreakers, I wanted to ask you, Andre, you know, what book or podcast are you reading now, or the latest thing that you've been reading?
I really enjoy listening to Freakonomics Radio, to be honest.
Brilliant.
It's a podcast based on a book, and they have been doing a tremendous job over the past years with very exciting topics, predominantly around economics, but, you know, they're exploring different areas. Really interesting.
Yeah, and I've read the Freakonomics book. I haven't had the chance to read the Super Freakonomics, the sequel to it. But did you come across any interesting economic theories? I mean, any of the podcasts? I mean, I recently was quite interested in the nudge theory that the both of them talked about a long time ago, about just moving things closer in shopping centres or food outlets to, you know, if they wanted to make people eat healthier, rather than putting all the crisps and the snacks at the front, if you put all the healthy sandwiches and so on near the front, you actually see a correlation between people picking that up more. I found that very interesting.
Indeed, Anik, I think that was one of the most interesting also episodes that they had on the show and also in the book. And I think because also it is related to my work on data, the whole idea around nudging has also permeated into the field of data, and we have a lot of talk nowadays about big nudging, so the use of data for digital nudging, so to speak, and I think that opened up a lot of interesting avenues of research.
Yeah, that is actually really fascinating, and we've spent quite a bit of time reading through your papers, and we can see that theme definitely throughout. I think that is a natural segue into the actual three questions of the show today, Deepak.
Yeah, I think that's as natural as you can get, really. Just kind of segued our way in really effervescently there. So, yeah, so this episode, we're really discussing big data, the benefits of big data, the concerns we have of big data. Andre's really done a lot of research in terms of, you know, the ethics around big data, the interactions in terms of legality with big data, and how we can actually regulate this facet and this aspect of society, which is really, you know, having such an influence on all walks of life, really. So this is something that we do need to place focus on, and this sort of research is so important to bring it out and have listeners engaging with it, because then they better understand, you know, how the data is being used, how it has the potential to change and develop societies in a more positive and beneficial matter, and then also, you know, the concerns we have and how the data is being used and manipulated for, you know, the political landscapes, so to speak. So, Andre, so could you tell us just a little bit about, you know, just a background about big data and your interest in big data and how you are interacting with this topic?
Deepak, thank you. Indeed, you mentioned it already. It is really important that people start engaging with this topic, because that's really where agency starts. Once you understand a phenomenon better, you are also able to engage with it in a very conscious way. And this is really where we see a big gap right now. There is so much happening in the field of data science, artificial intelligence, and so forth. But for most people, this is really just mere words, and their life goes on outside of that. But that also makes them ignorant, if you want, to what is really happening with them, how they are being nudged, how they are being manipulated to some degrees, and what is also the relationship with the data, both in terms of the data that they are producing and how it is being used for generating income for big corporations, but also the other way around. You know, what is the effect on the of data on them? And this is really also what interests me around the whole topic of data and big data specifically, and the digitalization that we're witnessing over the past few decades that has really accelerated to such a degree that any sort of anecdotal mentioning of how much data we are producing nowadays in one day as compared to 1 year ago over a whole year, or as compared to times before when the history of the world started being recorded in writing. You know, these anecdotal mentions nowadays don't make any sense anymore. We're producing so much data just in every second that just blows out of the water all the data that we've produced in the past. So, and given this very important change, I think it's really important to engage with that.
Yeah, I'm quite glad you kind of mentioned that that the acceleration within which data is being acquired and developed. Within one of the papers that that we read about regarding your work, I mean, there was that little kind of bite-sized information of a beginning of recorded history till 2003-2005. You know, you had 5 billion gigabytes of data, but then by 2011-2015 you've got, you know, sorry 2011 you had 5 billion gigabytes every 2 days, and now, you know, the latest one in the article was 2015, you have 5 billion gigabytes of data every 10 seconds. So you're really seeing this acceleration of data and the influence and the effect it's having in our day-to-day life. And I suppose you've kind of hinted at it already, but I think something that we're quite interested in is the idea of how important is it that we regulate big data? And maybe perhaps give us some examples of exactly why it is so important that we regulate big data and just the influence it is having on society on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. I think you're really hitting the nail on its head here. The situation really has drastically changed, specifically with the emergence of social media. We are still, ever since the emergence of social media, still living in a wild west of data, so to speak. Right now, we don't have any concept of data ownership or the definition of data as a object on which you can have property rights, outside the realm of contractual arrangements. And so the whole idea of data ownership really, really needs to yet be defined. And because it's not defined, what we find is that a lot of the data that is being produced is arranged through terms of use. So when you open up an account with Facebook, with Google, with Instagram, what have you, every time you have to click on an acceptance of the terms of use. These are contracts, and these contracts regulate exactly what these companies can do with your data and what is the relationship to the data that you've generated between you and them. And that is, I think, to many people not very clear, because these terms of use are really contracts that they make with these companies, and it determines their rights with regards to their own data.
That's a really interesting point, because I think, like myself and probably most others, we barely read any of the terms and conditions before we click accept on most of these apps that we accept or join. What more do you think we could be doing to help people understand what they're signing up to?
I think it is really important in the beginning to first understand that they're even doing something by clicking on these terms of use. Obviously, to read all the terms of use that you have to click on every day or every week in a given year exceeds the time that anyone has to actually do your own job and do your own work. But it is important to know that you're doing something with it. And it really starts with raising the awareness that the data that you are generating stops being yours as soon as you use these tools, such as social media tools like Instagram, for example. This data stops being only yours, and you stop having a certain rights around that.
Yes, and I think one of the concerns, I suppose, is how the data is being used. One of the aspects that you talked about was like predictive analysis. So being able to predict and guess and deduce, depending on your activity on social media, the kind of things that you like, the things that you say, or the things that you're buying off Amazon, certain companies, corporations, whether it be private or public, can predict, you know, your political affiliations, your decision making, your perception of society. I think that's, I suppose, the big concern there is the fact that, you know, this accumulation of data, the way this data is being used, is allowing these companies, is allowing, you know, for this manipulation of individuals and for their data to be used in this I suppose in an egregious manner.
Right, Deepak. Indeed, I think what came up with this whole collection of personally identifiable information through social media was really the opening up of the Pandora's box of marketing, so to speak. Be it now political marketing or be it economic marketing, makes no difference. But it gave us a glimpse, an insight into what people's thoughts are just by their expressions of what they think about, what they comment on, what they even look at. Because I don't even know whether most people are aware that just the fact that they might be hovering over a certain item on Facebook is being recorded as a data trail. And so attention span over certain items vis-a-vis other items is another variable that they are measuring, and that gives a lot of insight into your behavior and into your thinking.
And I certainly do think it is having an effect on the political landscape too. The way that we look at perhaps the rise of populist politics of right wing nationalist movements within the globe, I think there is certainly an undercurrent of big data having an influence in this.
Absolutely, what we have seen really is not a new phenomenon. We've heard recently in the news that Russia specifically, but every country really, is engaging in their own sort of propaganda on social media. But this is not something that is entirely new. Maybe the medium has changed to an online medium, but think back of Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Edward Bernays is credited of being the founder of modern marketing. And he's also the one that wrote the book on propaganda. And what was really his trick was he was able to connect human desires, what people really wanted, with another trigger phenomenon. So for example, he's credited with being the person that brought women in the United States to smoke. And how would he do that? He would have during protests around freedom and gender equality, he would have female models parading in short skirts, holding a banner that said freedom. And at the same time, while they are marching through the streets, they would be smoking, as in order to connect this idea of gender equality and freedom with the idea of smoking, something that used to be only for men. And so he was able to connect two aspects, the subconscious and the conscious, and thereby create a very strong marketing effect. And nothing else is happening right now with big nudging. The only difference is that companies have become so much more proficient in tailoring the nudges specifically to the individual because of the insights that they are generating into individual behavior, and thereby improving the marketing to a whole other level.
And I think that's the concern there, that big data has just made these methods and these approaches so much more effective and on such a bigger level, and hence why we're seeing these kind of massive concerns and big worries about how big data is being utilized by these big companies, and hence why I think you're in that position where you're saying regulation is insufficient and there needs to be more done to make sure that the way that big data is being utilized has more regulations. And I know you've made mention to the GDPR, which is the I think the general data protection regulations. And I think you were quite critical of it, saying it's not doing enough.
Indeed, I think what the GDPR really did, and that was really, really important, it really raised the awareness of the general public about the privacy implication of data use to a whole different level. People were, I think, very much taken aback in the beginning because they had to change a lot of the procedures and processes, how they would be treating personally identifiable information and how they would store it and what are the processes around it. But at the same time, it really raised the awareness that personal data is not something that can just be free floating and only becomes a problem when people come to harm. Because where the harm starts is really hard to determine. It's really hard to determine specifically because it depends on your definition of harm. So we talked briefly about the whole concept of nudging. Nudging is thus the use of triggers to elicit a certain behavior. Now, when nudging is becoming very obvious, so you know you're being nudged, it's all fine, right? You can still make your own decision around it. When nudging becomes something that you are unaware of, that you're being nudged, and it generates a desired behavior that is not, that is foreign to you, then nudging really takes away from your human agency, from your own decision making. And I think this is really where the problems start. And this is something that we that a lot of people were not aware before. And I think GDPR has really done a lot in order to elevate that awareness.
And I think that's a really, really interesting point you just noted on, particularly as we go into the next cycle of elections in the US and just in general in the UK, when we had our last election, that politicians and as well as potentially state or other actors are using big data to manipulate people's views and you know, in particular their voting habits. And that's kind of, you know, a follow-up question, I suppose, is then, you know, how has big data shaped the contemporary political landscape? In particular, how we as voters decide who we vote for.
Anik, this is a really important topic that you're raising here, because I think we started seeing it for the first time at around 2010. The Senate seat of Ted Kennedy was open, and what happened around that was a Twitter campaign tailored very much against the Democratic candidate. One would nowadays call it a smear campaign, but it was more than that, because it was not only run by individuals, but for the first time, they used the method of so-called Twitter bombing or astroturfing, where they used bots to generate automatically comments, negative comments about this Democratic candidate, and these bots would also automatically retweet the same messages, thereby creating a sort of a bubble, and that really was the start of, I think, where we saw the first time the implications of social media and the mix of social media and nudging. And nowadays it has really become a standard thing where Twitter is actively working on deleting the bots and deleting accounts that are run by bots that attempt these things, but we are by no means anywhere near where we can say for sure that there is no undue influence and that voter opinions are properly expressed on social media.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting area, actually. I mean, I noted in your paper, and you rightly pointed to Twitter's policies around, you know, the prohibition of astroturfing. However, it still ends up happening. And, you know, on that point, what do you think is the stance internally from these big social media companies towards astroturfing, and how do they actually work on preventing this?
So these big companies are very much aware that it is in their own interest to remain legitimate in order to prevent this astroturfing from happening. That being said, there is a lot of effort being done in order to prevent misleading information and fake news and all these terms that are being used nowadays to identify, so to speak, erroneous and misleading information. To get that out of the system. And I just read recently that there were on TikTok, there were 30,000 videos with relation to coronavirus deleted that contained wrong information about coronavirus. So this is really in the interest of these big companies. You asked also, how do they do it? Increasingly, there's a reliance on artificial intelligence for pattern recognition in order to identify bots. You can identify bots both by their behavior. For example, if somebody mentions a certain word in the tweet and that word triggers a response of retweets very swiftly, very short, at short notice, it becomes quite clear immediately that there is a set of bots behind that sort of retweeting. Now, if that is politically motivated, there is ways to identify that relatively easily. It becomes more complicated when it concerns bots that generate tweets themselves, because nowadays bots are increasingly relying on natural language processing to generate messages that can hardly be identified as non-human, so to speak. And so it's a bit of a battle going on between, so to speak, law enforcement and the criminals in a way. So those that use these Twitter bots to manipulate public opinion, and those that try to get a hold of it.
And I think that does really show really the concerns we have with big data and why. Your descriptions about the way in which big data is being utilized, especially on the social media platform, it's really highlighting that this does need attention, this requires attention, and we should be more wary and aware of, you know, the malpractices or the dangerous ways through which big data is being used and how it's more effective in influencing society. But then also on the flip side, you do mention some of the benefits of big data. It certainly has, or it has the potential to play a really influential role in the development of society, to deal with humanitarian issues, to deal with medical or educational issues. So I kind of also want to show and highlight that, yes, there are concerns about big data, and it certainly needs to be regulated, and there needs to be more exhaustive mechanisms to make sure that it's not being used in a matter that's not acceptable. But we also want to perhaps shed some light on the positives of big data and how it can really change society for the better.
For sure. I think one should not throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? It is important to realize that the whole discussion that started with the term big data is nowadays being continued, but under a different term, namely artificial intelligence. And nobody can deny that artificial intelligence, which in essence is the method to extract information out of big data, has really revolutionized a lot of the things that we are witnessing today. It has made the self-driving cars possible. It has deepened our insights into the universe, really, when it comes to pattern recognition and deep sky surveys. So the application of big data is really limited only by our own imagination, and the knowledge that can be generated out of it is tremendous. Just a very down-to-earth example. Within development aid, it is sometimes important to know where people are moving from A to B, maybe given droughts or given pandemics, like an Ebola outbreak, or even nowadays with regards to the spread of COVID-19. Now, this information can be generated based on, for example, call record data of cell phones. So you can trace where groups of people are going and at the same time how the virus is spreading. This can be really, really helpful information in order to get the spread of a virus under control. At the same time, there is a danger associated to that, because if the group that we are looking at that is moving belongs to a vulnerable group, maybe one that is politically targeted, then the potential what can be done with this data, the misuse potential, becomes really tremendous. And so I think, as with any tool that we see, both big data and artificial intelligence can be tools for good, and they can just as well be tools for bad.
That's a really good summary there, Andre. And I think over this last 20 minutes or so, that it's really clear that we do need to regulate big data. And there's clearly issues with how companies use it. And in particular, our knowledge as people and consumers of these big companies, apps and so on. But also, there is definitely a lot of benefits to the application. And in particular, during this recent kind of COVID pandemic, you can see clearly how, you know, countries have used big data to identify, isolate and protect people from this virus. And as we kind of move forward in your research around big data, one of the things that I was really interested in was your reference to Minority Report. And I'm a big fan of futuristic alternative universe type movies.
That's a good film for sure.
That's a very good film.
I do like that film.
Slightly scary, but it's good. But one of the things that I wanted to understand was where does big data stop? So will we end up in a world where all of our thoughts are digitized and companies will be able to know what we want to buy before we want it? Is that where we will end up?
I think that's where we already are, you know. Companies already know what we want and what we are going to buy, and the suggestions that they're making, they are sometimes really spot on. And so the question is not the... I don't think we are anywhere near an end point. I think we are yet in a situation where we need to sift out what is a service and what is unwanted interference with my own freedoms. And you mentioned the question around how can we manage that? How can we better regulate that? And I think this is really where the question of identity comes in. So what is my identity? What belongs to my part of identity? What kind of data belongs to my identity? And only then we will be able to think how we can manage that data that belongs to my identity with regards to companies that want to deal with that data.
Yeah, I think I always come back to this this example. I think I watched a TED talk about it, how depending on the a person buying a bigger bag, they're able to predict whether that woman is pregnant or not. And there's a great story where it was a 16-year-old girl, and she had bought a big bag. She'd bought a bigger bag, and she received information about being pregnant, and just generally, you know, the whole process of pregnancy. And her father was fuming about it. Was really angry about the fact that this information had been sent for his daughter, and was complaining. And then, you know, was shocked to find out, well, actually, my daughter, who's 16 years old, is pregnant. And I think that's, I suppose, the kind of crazy concerns that I suppose we're alluding to, is in the sense that you can start predicting things that you would not think have any correlation whatsoever. But, you know, they're able to find these issues out, find these correlations, and predict exactly what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. So I suppose that's perhaps why that question Anik is discussing of you know, how can we regulate it is so important, kind of the substantially how should we be able to regulate the use of big data.
Right. I mean, it's always scary when people know things about you that you're not yourself aware of. And with the example that you gave, I believe it was actually Staples that did that analysis, and they apologized afterwards. But of course, it's scary if others know that you're pregnant and you don't. It's even scarier if it's your own daughter. But yeah. The part is really, I think, the question is the whole idea around agency, right? The whole idea that if people know better how I work and how I think than I do myself, what triggers me, what makes me happy, what makes me sad, but also what makes me vote for left or right, then I'm losing that sort of agency that I need to be a fully ethical human being in this world, right? If I have less options to choose from because they're being chosen for me, then what makes me an ethical human being?
No, that is a really good point. And I always worry that I think I'm in control of the decisions I'm making, but am I really? And this is that point you make around conscious, subconscious, and you know, autonomy, so to speak. But you know, just thinking about that, what can we do then? As people who hold these ethics to a high regard, people that do want to have their own sovereignty, or at least feel like we have our own sovereignty over our decisions, as well as, you know, the big corporates and governments, what can we do to manage these risks and the risks of big data growing like this?
So I think one of the really interesting question is first, how can we manage our own data, right? So how can we ensure that the data that is mine is also regulated through my own volition? And there is a lot of suggestions around people needing to have control over their own data and then being able to decide what happens to the data. But I do really think that with the amount of data that we are already generating every single day, just by carrying our cell phone with us, this sort of influence on our own data, this sort of decision-making over our own data just will exceed everyone's capacity to consciously make a decision. And in the end, you will revert back into an apathy of what shall we do then with that data. So I think what will really be required is that there will be some data stewardship that on our behalf, a data ombudsman, so to speak, that on our behalf lobbies with regard to what can happen with our data and what not. And that requires a government that really takes data protection and privacy questions serious.
And I suppose one of the other things I certainly think could have an important role to play is human rights. I think you definitely made mention of it in your article regarding how coronavirus is perhaps changing the landscape of how big data and how it might, you know, open and broaden the boundaries through which, you know, the acquiring of data. And you did mention how, generally speaking, when we talk about human rights, there are certain rights that are derogated during a time of emergency, and one of them being the right to privacy. Is human rights a really effective tool in tackling the issues that we've got with big data?
The question around human rights is really, what do you do with them, right? I mentioned indeed in the paper that certain rights can be derogated during state of emergencies. And with privacy, this is such a thing, you know. At the same time, privacy was never designed to be a data regulation tool. The whole concept of privacy, at least in Europe, came actually still from what in German is called Briefgeheimnis, the secrecy of letters, right? That nobody of the government is allowed to open your letters, read them, and then send them on, and thus censorship should be prevented. Another aspect of privacy was the freedom within your own space. So nobody essentially should step over your fence into your garden and invade your own private sphere. And it's very hard to transform these two original concepts and where it came from into something that is fit for digital data that we are nowadays deal with. So I think that's why also the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, was such an important step, because it elevated this aspect, what was merely human rights, to something that is indeed EU-wide regulated. In addition to that, I think it is really important to see that human rights, the way they are designed from an individual's perspective, right? It is about my individual right to privacy. It's my individual right to data protection. But when it comes to data, and we saw that with COVID-19, it's not, most of the time, not only about my individual data, but it's about group identities, it's about group data, it's about what is nowadays called group privacy. And that is something that human rights frameworks at the moment simply cannot capture.
And I suppose, you know, coming from my kind of international law background, one of the frustrations I've always had with international law is that it's always a step behind the contemporary world. And international law sometimes is struggling with, you know, dealing with the complexities of contemporary world. And I suppose this is an aspect where certainly international human rights law, or human rights, generally speaking, does need to maybe step up and realize, well, the landscape, the environment that we're living in is changing, and certain rights are becoming more important and more less, it needs to be less vulnerable to the idea of derogation within which, in a climate where, you know, big data is becoming so important. So I think that's certainly alluding to the fact that we need to definitely rethink and reevaluate how we look at, you know, the right to privacy, and that, you know, the traditional conception of right to privacy is outdated, and we need to broaden our understanding and the legal structures and the legal instruments there to tackle these kind of issues.
For sure. And I think we blame a lot the law for not being up to date enough. But in the end, as lawyers, we also have a sort of margin of appreciation of legal terms and how they apply to today's world. Just because the laws don't change doesn't mean that a changing world doesn't require a reinterpretation of the same laws, at least up to that point where whole new concepts are necessary. And I think we are now a little bit in that, on that crossroads, where on the one hand, we need new concepts, such as indeed the concept of group privacy. But we also need the old laws still, and we can go a very long way with them and ensure that at least the individuals are being protected in their rights.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we really wanted to kind of end on, but also take a bit of time to explore, is how these ideas can change the world. So all this research you've been working on and putting together, it's certainly very interesting, and it's making us think a lot about what the world could be like over the next 10, 15, or even, you know, longer. But how can we harness big data technologies to transform and revolutionize the world, and in particular the developing world? And you mentioned a number of challenges with implementing big data techniques for development. But what could we do to solve those challenges? And I'm thinking in particular around crowdsourcing, for example.
Anik, that is a very interesting question. You mentioned in the beginning that you are very interested also in sci-fi literature.
Yes.
Now, there is a piece of literature, I think, that is really inspiring in this respect. And it is the last chapter of Isaac Asimov's I, Robot. In this last chapter, he describes a world that is essentially run by a set of several supercomputers. On each continent, there is one supercomputer that calculates how much jobs are needed, how much resources are needed, where people need to work, and so forth, in order to keep everyone happy. And I think this is for many people a little bit the ideal world where we are moving towards. But it wouldn't be Isaac Asimov if there was not also a moral to the story. And the moral is that in the end, these computers start becoming out of sync. There is a revolution starting here. There is protest starting there. And in a way, nobody can explain why the perfect data that is available and the supercomputers that try to manage the whole world are not getting to grasps with the complexities of human beings. And I think this is really where we must not forget that we are human first. We are non-rational beings for most part of our day. And only rational beings and being able to be managed by data second. So maybe that is a little bit disappointing for a future vision, but I think it's more realistic.
I do think it's amazing how I think a lot of sci-fi and just generally kind of the sci-fi genre is kind of almost being realized in society these days. And we made mention of two sci-fi stories already. And I think it is kind of, we are at the precipice of that. We're kind of walking into that world where, you know, this is certainly going to become the reality.
Yeah, it's exciting to live in a world where sci-fi is becoming our daily lives. If you remember watching as a child Star Trek with the tricorders and the tablets that they were working with, we are literally sitting with these tablets nowadays at home and browsing the internet, watching YouTube. I mean, this really has already transformed, and this is really where the value of the creative arts and the humanities lie, because and maybe it is a bit of a plaidoyer also for the humanities. Because engineering and data science can go so far. They can really propel the world to a whole new realm. But what does it mean for our living together? What does it mean for our ethics? These are really answers that only the humanities can answer. Questions that only humanities can answer. And I think this is why both the hard sciences and the soft sciences, they will both remain important.
That's a really good point you mentioned on the humanities and making sure it still exists after this crisis. Me and Deepak speak a lot about the university system, and we were both sharing our worries and concerns about the funding change that will inevitably happen because of this crisis, with many universities struggling potentially to keep afloat. And we hope humanities isn't one of the areas they sacrifice or reduce funding to, but it is probably something they will look at.
And in many countries, you see the humanities losing their foothold indeed. But at the same time, big and very prestigious universities, such as Oxford University, have recently been able to dedicate quite a lot of funding to the humanities perspective on questions such as big data and artificial intelligence, realizing the importance of that. So I think that the corona crisis indeed will force hard decisions, and these hard decisions will usually turn out in favor of where the currency is, where the money is. And probably we'll have to live with that for a while, but doesn't mean that the humanities aren't creative enough to reinvent themselves into whatever you want to call it, digital humanities maybe, in order to be able to get a bite of that chunk of money and to continue staying afloat.
And yes, I think humanities is especially important when we talk about big data. You certainly made reference to the fact that, you know, conventional or traditional interactions with ethics or deontology is perhaps, you know, needing a bit of a shake-up, and it needs to be a bit more invigorated so it can interact with big data and with the world that we're living in. I think you've certainly made mention to that. I think it's something very important, why that's exactly why humanities, philosophy, ethics is still an important aspect and an important region that we need to continue researching in.
Right. The current developments are really a chance for the traditional fields of academia, such as philosophy, such as ethics, such as the humanities, to get out of their dusty chambers and engage with something that is really pertinent and problematic at the moment. And the truth is that a lot of my colleagues are getting engaged and are getting interested in topics such as how can we, you know, replace laws through digital means, maybe by the use of blockchain technology and so forth. So I think it's really a time where we start realizing that we can actually apply knowledge that we've generated and harnessed it for some time in the past, nowadays also for good new use to these novel developments.
It's really, really interesting. And I just wanted to pick up on one point, which is more of a personal interest. You mentioned Asimov earlier, and I just wanted to see if you've read the Foundation series that he published a long time ago. And I asked that because Deepak mentioned earlier about how sci-fi and some of these stories are literally coming to life. And Elon Musk, for example, is a big fan of his books. And his idea of going to Mars is kind of the starting point for him to follow through with Isaac Asimov's stories, in that we need to spread our knowledge throughout the universe because we will inevitably destroy ourselves.
Absolutely. I think the interesting thing around the Foundation trilogy, originally a trilogy and then later expanded, was that It mentions the concept of psychohistory, right? And psychohistory is the science of extrapolating the history of the future from the data of the past. And that is really fascinating because it has so many touching points with what we are doing nowadays with big data. And it is based on certain principles such as that it requires a large enough data set, that it requires people about who the history is being made being unaware of that prediction about them, otherwise they are able to counter steer it and so forth. So there's a lot of really interesting things wrapped in sci-fi literature that only nowadays we start understanding, I think, even more concretely what they really mean. And so I think sci-fi is indeed a great source for future looking research.
Absolutely, and definitely some good source of entertainment too, alongside some really fascinating perceptions into where we're going. And I suppose we can kind of wrap it up now and conclude in highlighting and showing that big data is going to have a huge effect on society. It's going to change the world for the better. It's got the capacity and the potential to change the world for the better and improve so many aspects of everyday life. But in Andre's work, we can definitely see that, you know, with that potential, there needs to be some responsibility. There needs to be some push and attention on regulation and on curtailing the way in which big data is being utilized, whether it be by the private or public sector. Just to kind of wrap it up, Andre, just kind of a few concluding words, just on that idea of big data having that capacity to transform and improve society for the better. Let's know.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that people like us, people that are aware of the potential for good and for bad, keep on pushing both governmental and private actors to do the right thing. Corporations will always go where the financial interests lie. But financial interests change very much with the willingness of customers to accept certain practices. And we see it nowadays in the practice of many big corporations that privacy by design is really something that sells well. So I think our job is really to keep on making people aware of what the good and the bad and the ugly of big data and artificial intelligence can be in order for them to make the right choice, but also in order for corporations and governments to keep on improving both the services, but also the well-being of human beings.
Professor Switter, it has been a huge pleasure to have you on. I wish we could have had you on for a bit longer, maybe have like a 2 to 3 hour interview, because, you know, this kind of topic you can really talk about, you know, at such a long length. But thank you very much for accepting our invitation, and it's just been a huge pleasure.
Thank you also very much for having me. The pleasure was all mine. It was a wonderful conversation, and I'm hoping that maybe we can continue this conversation at some point in the future.
That's definitely a possibility.
Okay, so that was the interview with Professor Andre Switter. What a first episode. I think that was, for me, so stimulating. And one of the big takeaways, and reflecting on it after the interview, is that it's the kind of conversation where you listen back to it and you take something completely different from it. Because I think big data is one thing, but you're able to just explore so many different elements and so many different facets and aspects of society. And the biggest takeaway, I think, in the actual episode, I said something along the lines of, we're on the precipice of the future, but I actually think we're in the future. This is the future that we've kind of written about, dreamt about in sci-fi and all the kind of films and books where we talk about, you know, all these kind of scientific ideas. We're really in it now, for sure.
No, definitely, Deepak. I think one of the things that we talked a little bit about was the different sci-fi books, about the Foundation series and some of the things that Philip Dick has written in the past, when you think about Total Recall and Minority Report even. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, I did a little bit of reading after the interview of kind of like predictive policing, I think it is they're calling it now.
Wasn't it predictive analysis?
Well, predictive analytics is kind of the, let's say, umbrella term they're using to analyze variables that could predict a future outcome. But I was looking at how like the police force are using it, for example, in the US or in China and stuff like that. And that's slightly scary. And it's definitely Minority Report vibes, where they're going to look at different variables in one's background and determine the likelihood of that person committing a minor level crime or a very serious crime, and looking to take intervening action a lot earlier. So you're kind of, I don't know, policing before the crime has happened, which in theory sounds great. Like, of course, you want to prevent crimes before they happen, which, you know, like with medicine, right? You want to prevent you getting the disease rather than curing the ailments after you get it. But this sounds very different. And, you know, people are going to have to tread a very fine line.
For sure. It's kind of scary, right? You haven't even made a decision yet, but your fate is already set. It's kind of it's quite a scary idea. Yeah. So one other thing that I was really interested in after listening back to the interview is the idea that big data is allowing social media platforms to create more effective propaganda machines. And a good example of that would perhaps be the campaigning and advertising of this faux treatment, chlorine dioxide, within certain countries in South America. So in particular, Ecuador, where the rolling ball effect of it led to the Ecuadorian Congress actually discussing whether this is actually a plausible treatment for COVID-19, even though scientists were discrediting this and were saying this is really not a viable treatment for COVID-19. So it kind of shows how big data can be utilized to target certain people to create a narrative, which is quite dangerous.
Yeah, and certainly if that, you know, whoever's producing that product wants to increase their sales, they could use Facebook, they could use Twitter to target people that they think would want to buy it and believe whatever false claims are out there. And that's also another problem with social media. I mean, the big data is obviously one aspect, but the speed at which information can travel without any kind of credible authority stamping, you know, placing a stamp of a kind of approval on that information is staggering, right?
Absolutely. And hence why I think Andre certainly pushes for greater regulation of the way in which big data can be used, because you know, social media platforms, even, you know, let's not even talk about social media platforms, but, you know, companies such as Amazon can utilize your big data to then advertise certain products to you, which is a scary idea to a certain degree. So, yeah, that's something that I feel we're going to definitely talk about again in the future with other experts. And it's something that we definitely need to be aware of. Yeah. And yeah, this was such a, Andrea is a really interesting person, and we definitely felt like it was the kind of starting episode for us to embark on this House of Wisdom podcast journey. So really happy and excited to kind of share this out with our listeners. I suppose we can wrap it up now. It's been a pleasure. I've definitely enjoyed this first episode. Check us out on Twitter. So our Twitter handle is Howl Podcast, so HOWW Podcast. And check us out on Instagram, House of Wisdom Podcast, all lowercase, no spaces, no underscores or anything like that. House of Wisdom Podcast, check us out on there, and our website. Nick, anything else to add?
I think that's all that's left is good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.